Welcome to the Business Marketing Club podcast for B2B marketing people who want to get on and stay ahead. In each episode, we'll be offering insight and inspiration on a key current topic, advice on how to climb the career ladder, and top networking tips. My name's Dave Stevens. I'm a B2B marketer, and I'm chair of the Business Marketing Club Network. In this episode, I'll be speaking to Matt Morrison, the head of strategy at Digital Whiskey, for his advice on content marketing measurement. Santu Kottala, the CMO of Lidu, will offer his account-based marketing experience, and it's not what you expect. And Ben Perkins, the client and markets director of Deloitte UK, Ros Barclay, the director of marketing and PR agency Coverdale Barclay, and the Drums Rising Star of 2019, Alexandra Weber, will share some great B2B marketing examples and what they've learned from them. Lots to do. Are you listening comfortably? Then we'll begin. Marketing is so focused on delivering content and digital advertising nowadays, so it's more important than ever that we're able to measure the results of that focus. I'm joined by Head of Strategy at Digital Whiskey, Matt Morrison, to share his experience. Matt, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks, brilliant to be here.
So I guess first of all, why should we care to measure this content marketing?
I think this is a wonderful question. I find that most people don't. Most people find that publishing is almost a goal enough.
Yeah, it's enough. Tick in the box, let's move on.
It's out. And yet, if you do begin to measure it, you throw up all sorts of interesting new questions. So, for example, are we doing the right thing? Are we doing it as well as we could be? A beautiful example of this. We were looking at the insights section of a firm's website, and we had plugged in the LinkedIn insight pixel, free bit of code you put in your site, and amongst other things, it will tell you who is visiting various the pages that you've put it on. And so we were able to look at who was visiting which area of the site, and we found that for this particular law firm, the bit of the site where senior people were going was to look at the partner pages. Who's on the other side? Who is this person? Who am I dealing with? But as we moved into the insight section, the bit where the firm was displaying its expertise, it was almost exclusively other law firms that were looking at this content. And the more we dug into this, we went off, we asked people questions, and eventually we found somebody who said, yes, no, that's just normal. These days, a young associate will come in, they won't use Westlaw to do their research, they'll just use Google, and Google turns up these pages, and so this is how we're creating consensus in the market. So they're producing huge amounts of content aimed at clients, which may well be sent out to clients, but as far as the website goes, it was only being seen by competitors and internal audiences.
Okay. So that's kind of an example of a business that is measuring its content marketing, but they're not maybe doing anything about that measurement.
But it allowed us to then go off and start running ad campaigns. We ran very small LinkedIn content promotion campaigns aimed at the seniority and industries that we thought should be reading this. And suddenly, overnight, we were able to change the complete makeup of those sections of the site. And I think that's the important thing, particularly about content marketing, is that too long we've relied on Google to deliver our audience rather than advertising. Now, back in the old days, you could put content up and you would build audiences. But even then, you had to look at it to think, what's working? And possibly that could skew things. So, for example, years ago, I wrote the blog section of our agency website, different agency. And we were delivering a lot of traffic. And I was thrilled. I felt like I was doing my job. And everything was working. And eventually, I realized that there was one article that was driving nearly all this traffic. This article wasn't about what we did for a living. It was about how do you find the data in an Excel chart if in a PowerPoint chart, if the Excel chart isn't embedded alongside it. So if somebody sends you a PowerPoint with a chart, you want to take those data out of the chart. Mm. And there was a way of doing it, and I thought it was very interesting. Mm. And that was delivering nearly all the traffic to the site, one which had nothing to do with what our agency did as a business. It was almost like a note to myself so I didn't forget how to do it.
Yeah.
And this was delivering the traffic. And there were two things you could begin to think of as, you know, one, we should write more stuff about Excel, which is, I argue, the wrong thing. And the other is to think, is this blog doing the job it's supposed to be doing?
Okay. Okay, so I guess I can be persuaded that there's value in measuring my content marketing because I can do it better as a result,
or even stop doing it at all.
Okay,
I mean that always has to be one of the options when you're evaluating.
Absolutely.
Something.
So what should I measure?
I think the straightforward Google Analytic tools are good up to a point. However, you do need to look at this in combination with things. So we talk a lot when we're talking to clients about companion metrics. Mm. As you're measuring one thing, what's the other metric that's almost adjacent to it, which might be affected? So, for example, we know that we can easily increase traffic volume on a site using advertising channels. What happens to the quality of that traffic? And for that, we have to have some sense of what quality looks like.
Sure.
So that could be time on page, which requires a bit of fiddling, or it could be, for example, who's looking at it, that, you know, those LinkedIn insights, which work really well for B2B and don't work at all for B2C. Mm. We have tools here which allow us to look at, as we push down on one side of the seesaw, what's happening on the other side.
Okay. And is it true that you would take the same approach for measuring the content marketing in one business as another? You know, does one size fit all?
So far, across professional services firms, where lead generation may not be the primary goal, that has been the case.
Okay.
That we've been able to, what we've learned from one client has translated very nicely over to the next.
Regardless of size?
I think perhaps the size of the niche that they're talking to defines this much more than the size of the firm.
Okay.
I think a small firm should be able to outperform and punch above its weight much more easily. I think the difficulty for large firms is actually much more internal. How do we retool our processes rather than how do we retool what we're in?
Okay, and how about outside of professional services?
So I've come from consumer marketing originally. I look within that. I used to look at tech and finance. So those would be my nearest comparisons to this sector. I still think that understanding the cost of producing your content, the longevity of that content, its value through time, its the way it contributes to your message. So how far does this align with your business interests? How far does it deliver against those? These are quite soft questions. These are not always number questions. But we do need to have some kind of measure for these. Mm. And I think that as we move sort of through this, we need to find those will differ pretty radically between sectors. But we still need to find ways of answering those questions, even if the tools we use are different.
And you mentioned that you have a B2C background. What can B2B learn from B2C in this space?
I think the there is one clear thing that everyone in B2C more or less understands, that very few people in B2B have internalized, and that is that these data are probabilistic. These are not accurate reflections of what's happening. We don't value, we don't credit all of the value in a transaction to the last click. There isn't some straightforward journey that somebody takes down some funnel. These things work at large numbers. We're looking for clues. We're not looking at the truth. And I think that's a really hard thing for B2B with their sort of rational approach to understand. Whereas B2C people, we know we're dealing with populations. They're just very large populations.
That's a great answer. Matt Morrison, thank you very much.
It's a great pleasure.
We've had lots of guests on the BMC podcast over the last few weeks talking about account-based marketing, its importance, the need to get on the journey and talking about the sorts of things that businesses should be doing to get started. My next guest on the topic of ABM is going to talk about something slightly different. So I'm joined today by CMO of Lidu, Santu Kotala. Santu, thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Dave.
And I think it's especially interesting to have you as a guest on ABM because your business doesn't use it.
Well, we had a brief discussion about this before the recordings and I'd say it's a definition game. And as marketeers, we love to define stuff, especially if they come out of three letters. So account-based marketing,
okay.
ABM.
That's really killing them for me to ask you the question, well, what is ABM in your book?
Well, actually, I looked down the definition from the internet, of course.
Of course.
So account-based marketing is a business marketing strategy that concentrates resources on a set of target accounts within a market. And then the techniques can vary, of course. So, but how I would add the definition, because of course I'm not satisfied with the one that I found on internet, like no marketer ever, it's a really good tool when you know all your customers by name. So basically, if you work on a certain industry or a certain niche, or let's say with just the Fortune 500 companies.
Right.
But when you operate on various industries, focus on smaller companies than the enterprises, I wouldn't say that the tight definition of account-based marketing isn't the thing that we do.
Okay.
At Lidu.
Okay. And we should probably come to just a little bit about Lidu itself. It's a relatively young business, right?
Mm. Yeah.
And so does that govern the kind of marketing that you've tended to do? You don't know who your customers are because when you started out you didn't have any customers. And so you've had to use other techniques to be able to bring them on board.
Well, actually, that is a good question. It's a really good topic because marketers don't necessarily get to talk about business strategy. Mm. And I've had the privilege of being in a growth company, in a startup, and I've been in the core of our business strategy. And we made a decision that we won't be after the big guys. We won't go after the enterprise clients for the sole reason that they take months to make a decision.
Right.
When compared to SMEs who make decisions quickly.
Much more quickly.
Yeah.
Okay.
So I wouldn't say that our solution isn't for enterprises because a lot of enterprises have contacted us themselves, but we just made the decision not to go after them so that we get the business running as quickly as possible.
Okay. So then I guess that begs the question, okay, you're deciding to go after smaller businesses because they're quicker and faster, but you could surely go after some high-profile
smaller
businesses and run account-based marketing with them.
That's a good idea. Would you love to come to work with us?
I can't for the next couple of days because I'm recording these podcasts, but you know, I'm at a very reasonable rate thereafter.
Yeah. Well, actually, that comes down to the differences in markets between, for example, Scandinavia and UK.
Okay.
So in Finland, quite the opposite from UK. In Finland, you can find the phone number of a publicly listed company's CEO from the company's website, and you can call him or her. And if you have something interesting, they will respond themselves and not like put it down to a CMO who puts it down to a head of marketing who puts it down to a marketing manager who puts it down to a marketing specialist.
That's interesting. So, and in the UK, you can't do that.
Well, apparently.
So do you think there are any kind of key social reasons why the UK and Finland are so different in this regard?
Yeah, I think it has something to do with the size and the fact that London, there's a lot of triers, so to say, in London, for example. Mm. In Finland, the market is so small that if you mess it up, everyone will know that it was you.
Sure.
So it creates this like circle of trust, because you cannot mess it up, because otherwise you are in problems.
Okay.
But in UK, there's a lot of triers, so I understand why people in this market are more skeptic about new ideas.
Mm.
Because you get offered a lot of magic wands, so to say.
There are certainly a fair few out there. So I guess I'd still like to try and pick at this a little bit. So you could still have those high profile small businesses. You could still generate or collect some insight about them. Okay, maybe not through the phone book, but you know, there are other ways, social media, for instance, of being able to get underneath the skin of some high profile SMEs. Still intrigued why that's not been a technique you've chosen to adopt.
Well, I think it comes down to time, of course, and the other part is the definition game that I mentioned earlier on. So we do marketing automation with picked industries and industry size companies, of course. But when I define or try to make a difference between marketing automation, content marketing, and account-based marketing, I would say that account-based marketing is something that drives your like whole marketing business. And marketing automation, for example, for us, is something that we do, but it's at the moment it's not the most important
thing. Right, got it. So I get and I buy that maybe ABM isn't so important for you guys right now. How about in your previous roles? Have you used the techniques of account-based marketing in the past? And kind of where has it been useful to you?
Well, before Lidu, I worked at the biggest media company in Finland called Sanoma, and basically their media business, so selling advertising, was around the 200 biggest advertisers in Finland.
Mm.
So that was a field where we had really tight connections with all our clients. But then due to the fact that Sanoma is really big, it's like you cannot do an advertising campaign without talking to them.
Mm.
So it was somehow a funny place that it was an environment where account-based marketing could have been executed, but they wouldn't need to.
Yeah. Okay. So you've kind of not really been in a place, I guess, where you found that the techniques of ABM are useful to you.
Not at a scale. Mm. So, of course, in Finland, when we started the business and also in certain other aspects of the business, we've picked up a few customers that we think that these would be good references.
Mm.
But like I said, in Finland, if we would say that we would want this business as our customer, we could call them.
Sure. Okay.
So any UK people, if you want to... to get your job to be a lot more easier, come to Scandinavia.
Yeah. No, I'm strictly ex-directory. Santi Kotler, CMO of Lidu, thank you very much for your time today.
Thank you, Dave.
B2B marketing is amazing, and it's time to celebrate it. Because it's the toughest profession in business, our profession's younger than FMCG, it's still got to prove itself. So you've got to prove yourself in a skeptical environment. Business doesn't get B2B marketing, and so you've got to persuade and explain and lead the way. Add to that the multiple internal stakeholders with multiple external customer groups. There's no longer just one buyer, there's many with different needs, opinions, expectations, and there's no one to help you. All the marketing professional bodies focus on FMCG rather than B2B. You're on your own. And so given all of that, it's absolutely amazing that there's some great B2B marketing out there. And I'm joined now by Clients and Markets Director at Deloitte, Ben Perkins, to look at some of it. Ben, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you.
So what's caught your eye out there?
So I think there's a, and this is quite dangerous territory for me, because what I'm going to do is talk about what some of my competitors are doing really well.
Okay.
So I'm risking deflecting attention away from me and my company. But I think it's best to be honest and open about these kind of things.
And your competitors can come on this podcast and repay the compliment if they'd so like.
I really hope they do. That would be fantastic and get me out of jail in terms of this one as well. So there are two things really in terms of competitors that I'd like to talk about in terms of successful campaigns. So my world is really thought leadership and marketing in that sense. To a great example of a company that's doing this really well, I think to a large part, is BCG, Boston Consulting Group. They run a really cool series called How To. It's very bold. It's strong in terms of the branding. It's clearly designed for a digital-first approach. It has simple, clear, actionable messaging within it. Exactly the kind of thing you want to browse on your phone, your iPad, etc. Well, as you're going about your daily work. So brilliant from that sense. And then almost, if it lets itself down at all, it's when you click through, it's through to the old corporate website where the content sits and resides. So
Right. Fantastic
front end, slight disappointment at the back end. But again, they're thinking the how-to name is about practical solutions for people to read the insight and to be able to do something about it. So
it's bold. What does that actually mean? How is it bold? And what is the consequence of it being bold?
So what I think is, it's both bold in terms of the design, the feel of it, but also bold in terms of the objective of it. So as we know, strategy consultants love to talk. They love to talk at length, go into tremendous amount of detail around things. But this is so light, so simple, so visually striking and sort of powerful in terms of short, sharp messaging throughout. So I think it's a very bold step for a company that's all about its deep expertise and thinking to go for something that's so sort of light.
So it links a little bit with what you were saying about how people can use it. It's something they can dip into during the day.
Absolutely.
And I guess just generally, if we kind of step away from the example for a moment and just talk about the way that you generate thought leadership, you have to think as you're generating the thought leadership a little bit about the way that you're going to take it to market and what form it needs to take and who your audience is.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And the other thing is that I think that most marketers will completely buy into that, but then they get kind of caught in this trap. And the trap is, we've spent X hundred of hours on this. We've spent X thousands of pounds on research. We've spent all of this stuff. So therefore, we've got to show what we spent all this time and money doing, which equates to large, unwieldy reports, and etc. So to invest in the same process, the same rigor, the same sort of supporting evidence and stuff that goes into it, but then to say, but I'm only going to convey the simplest of messages, actually takes a lot of guts.
The second thing you said about how-to was it's branded. So I'm guessing that's slightly more than just bunging a BCG logo on it.
Exactly. So kind of it's branding in terms of imagery, in colours, in shapes. The site's quite dynamic. It's moving. It's animated within that. It is responsive in terms of the design. So as you scroll through, it's changing and adapting to the size of your screen, etc. So everything that we've kind of been taught is best practice around digital marketing.
But would you go as far as saying it's a piece of thought leadership that could only be produced by BCG?
No.
Okay.
No, I, I, I wouldn't. So kind of, I think that both they and the other example that I was going to choose of an even bigger competitor, Accenture, and their presence on Instagram, again, is just two examples of where big professional services brands, big B2B marketing brands, have had the confidence to kind of learn from B2C and start to incorporate some of those elements into their campaigns and around thought leadership and stuff like this to put as much effort into the marketing as the production of the sort of the content.
Mm. And so how do you design thought leadership for digital?
That's a really good question. And I think that in terms of designing, so if you were to think about designing the research or the construction of hypotheses, et cetera, I don't think you necessarily do anything differently. I think that what you do differently is it's about the communication. So it's about your tone of voice. It's about the language that you use. It's about the amount of text that you use. It's about you don't follow a linear traditionally academic paper type approach.
Okay.
You start with the most important stuff. It's much more of a journalistic endeavor, I guess.
Okay. And so looking at how-to overall, what is it that you take from that that you would like to be able to apply at Deloitte?
So I think the challenge that I've accepted from doing this, and we're starting to do this more and more, is to have the confidence to really pare it back, to go with the really simple, high impact messages, the really sort of key impactful statistics, to know that you've done the work, the rigor, everything sits behind it. Your client, your reader, they take that for granted because it's got your logo on it, right? That's what 175 years of Deloitte or whoever means, right? So they've assumed that. They're there. They're reading it. They've bought it. They've come to the dance, and now they want to dance. So it's just in terms of being really sort of committing to it in terms of these are the most important things. I'm deciding and curating this for you. Trust me.
Client and Markets Director at Deloitte, Ben Perkins. Thanks very much.
Yeah, thank you.
My next guest is Ros Barkley, Director of Marketing and PR Agency, Coverdale Barkley. Ros Barkley, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks very much for having me.
So, some great B2B marketing and comms out there. What's caught your eye?
Most recently, I was at a presentation on a really big regeneration scheme in Edinburgh. The presentation was in London. But there was a really impactful video that they had prepared to sell this scheme. It's an enormous regeneration scheme in the centre of the city that's led by retail, but there's offices, there's a hotel, there's other commercial space, there's leisure uses, so it's a large-scale project. And the video was about 3 minutes long,
okay.
Had a great soundtrack. The audience was, it was designed to attract tenants to the scheme, retailers for argument's sake. And it did an amazing job of bringing the scheme to life. So we were sitting in this slightly boring room in London, and I felt like I was having a city tour of Edinburgh. And it wasn't just the music. It was about the pace, and the photography was so powerful. There were hardly any words on the screen. And actually, the following presentation, which was a guy standing up in front of us, for me wasn't really required because the scheme was sold just in this 3 minute video. It was fantastic. It was one of the best things I've seen in ages.
Oh, that sounds amazing. So perhaps help us picture the scene a little bit, because I've quite a lot of experience of those sorts of presentations. And there's a big decision to be made about where do you put the video in the course of the presentation. You know, is it the thing that grabs people's attention at the start? Is it the thing that kind of wakes people up during the middle? Or is it, you know, the big thing to go out? So how was it positioned?
Right at the beginning.
Okay.
Before any words were spoken by the main presenter. And it was just inspiring. So what he, in a way, he didn't really need to say anything because the video did the selling for him. And it just gave the audience an understanding of what this place would feel like emotionally. It was about creating an emotional connection to the this amazing regeneration scheme.
That's interesting too, because actually increasingly in our business, there's kind of a growing awareness that emotion plays a greater role in the sell. Is that your experience in your space?
Absolutely fundamental. I think it's true of any marketing and PR activity. Mm. You've got to have a sense of empathy. You've got to understand your audience, and how do you do that if you don't put yourself in their shoes? What does it feel like? What's the emotional response? How are we inspiring people? Mm. Because decisions aren't made rationally. They're, you know, part of decision making is rational, but actually it's a lot to do with emotions, feelings, thoughts, and so on.
Okay. And of course, what you're marketing here is a building, I guess,
or a place.
So how do you get people emotionally involved or connected with a place?
I think ultimately you're selling them a lifestyle. And that could be, you know, in the case of this scheme, which we don't actually work on, it could be, you know, explaining what a day out would look like. You know, increasingly people are buying less stuff and they're spending money on experiences. And that's what it was selling. It was selling what a day might look like or a visit might look like, whether you live locally or whether you're, you know, traveling from somewhere else in the world. It was this sense of experience, this unique experience that I would get when I visited.
And I guess part of the appeal too was it's play, the videos play to the visual. So you mentioned that there were no or very few words in the mix at all, which I think for you and I is actually quite a tricksy type of thing, because we tend to specialise a bit in the words and the importance of those. So tell me a little bit more about that. How is it that worked in this particular film?
I think because it brought it to life visually, and, you know, what it feels like to be there, to experience this place, is easier to articulate in pictures, photography, videos, than it ever will be in words. Because there's a much more emotional response to seeing a video. And actually, it's a real leap of faith, because people rely on words. You know, if you look at the worst presentations you've ever sat through, it's, you know, pages and pages, slides and slides with 100 words per slide. And you think, I went to an amazing thing on Tuesday night called a Petra Kutcher, which is every speaker was allowed 20 seconds per slide, and they're allowed 20 slides.
Wow.
That was it. So every speaker had 6 minutes, 40 seconds. And the pace was brilliant. We got through 6 in an hour and a half, and it meant we didn't have to sit through lots of words. They were just visuals, and it meant you could focus on what the speaker was saying rather than reading what was on the screen.
Mm. And going back to the film, what have you learned from seeing that you've then gone on to apply in what you do on a day-to-day basis?
Feel confident that less is more. I.e. less words is actually more impactful. Mm, and I think I reflected on that since I saw that video, and I thought, you know what, in some of our pitch presentations or presentations to clients, you don't need 50 words on a screen. You need between 5 and 10, and then you talk about it. All that's on the screen is a prompt, really, to then have a conversation with someone, or to prompt an action, or, you know, prompt debate. Mm. So I think recognizing that what's up on a screen isn't, you're not selling everything in words on a screen, you're selling everything face to face across a table.
Great advice. Ros Barkley, Director of Marketing and PR Agency Coverdale Barkley, thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
My next guest is the Drums Rising Star of 2019, Alexandra Weber. Alex, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks for having me back, Dave.
So, great B2B marketing that's out there right now. What's caught your eye?
So something that's caught my eye lately is Savanta have recently launched their 2020 B2B marketing trend tracker. And there's actually been quite a discrepancy between how agency side and client side marketers rank the trends. Something that's really stood out for me is emotional engagement.
Okay.
Now, as a agency side marketer, it's something that's really hardwired into us. Emotionally engaging an audience is absolutely one of the most crucial things. So for agencies, it's ranked number 3. Mm. But for B2B clients, it's ranked as number 10th.
Yeah.
And I just found this really interesting, because I feel that is this either potentially because client-side marketers see this as an agency's role, so aren't having it forefront of mind, or actually the reason I think it has rated so lowly is that they don't see how emotional engagement can impact their bottom line.
Right.
So something that's really interested me lately is the IBM's Call for Code campaign. It's recently won a few awards for best use of creative, and for those of you who are familiar with it, they've rolled out the case study film to many film festivals lately, and it's just been amazing. But for me, it was a real mix of emotional engagement, consumer engagement, customer engagement, sorry, and influencer marketing.
Okay, so there's a lot there. So maybe if we go back first of all and look at that really astonishing difference between the way agencies look at emotional engagement and the way that clients do. Does that create challenges as an agency side person in terms of marketing into client side? Because you're kind of saying, hey, wow, here's something that's really emotional, and we client side are saying,
So to be honest with you, it completely depends on the client. Some people are so much further ahead in realizing the true impact that emotional engagement can have. But obviously a lot of client-side marketers have the pressure from their C-level, their boards, who are saying, we just want to see the impact on the bottom line. And it is not the thing you go to when you think about what's going to really make a difference to our brand, especially with attribution, modelings and things. Is emotional engagement going to be that stream that goes through there? Mm. It's not the thing they go to. So interestingly, actually, I know I referenced influencer marketing, but for both agencies and clients, that ranked right at the bottom of this report. Mm. But as marketers, we really need to start realizing that, and I hate this term, so I'm sorry for using it, but it's human-to-human marketing.
Right, okay.
I really hate that term. But it's true. We are trying to connect with an audience of heavily marketed to customers.
Mm. Okay, so I've heard of the IBM Call for Code campaign, but just kind of fill us in and tell us a bit more about it.
Yeah, so just a quick overview of what the campaign is. IBM had a real problem, especially amongst the developer community. They had no confidence in IBM's offering. They weren't seen to be innovative, they weren't seen to be good for community engagement, and they weren't seen to have technical prowess, which as a B2B tech brand in this day and age is awful to have your own community see you that way. So not to be seen as relevant or pioneering was a real risk for IBM. But they also realized that humanity had a bigger problem, that natural disasters were having a huge impact on our economy and our society. So IBM saw this as an opportunity to bring together the development community to do something for good. So bring their code and their CSR goals together to do something for real good. So they actually opened up their code and launched the world's largest hackathon, launching with 400 local hackathons, looking at how they could solve, humanitarian issues and disasters for the better, for good.
Okay.
So what they did was they did all these amazing hackathons, and they really, really engaged the media with this. They used all the IT influencers. They really engaged their community on something that really mattered to them. Mm. And every single time they came up with a solution for this using code, they went to the media. They built a beautiful feature-length case study around this. And they've engaged with charities. They've engaged with government officials. And IBM have now led the way with their development community to make an impact on the world. But most importantly for IBM, they have really impacted their bottom line through this.
I was going to ask you about this. So it sounds great for planet Earth, and obviously that's very important. But can you tell us a little bit more about what the actual impact was for IBM themselves?
Yeah. So they, for the first time in years, had actually seen real growth. And an extreme amount of that had come from the development revenue.
Right.
And if you think of as a B2B campaign, it is very emotional. It's one that everyone can engage with. I mean, they actually reached 1.1 billion people, 1.1 billion social engagements when they launched this campaign on World Humanitarian Day. So, the kind of top level, beautiful, big stats are there, which all of us marketers love. But at the end of the day, their development community saw what they could do with their code. They saw the true value that IBM could have, and it reinstalled their trust. And as such, they spent more money with them.
Wow.
So
That's pretty amazing. Win-win, then.
Win-win.
It's really interesting that you talk about the IBM campaign, because these sorts of hackathons are increasingly being used by marketers, aren't they, now as a technique to try to engage and really rally people to a particular brand cause.
Yeah, they are. And actually, if you know your audience well, the developers are bombarded with hackathon requests.
Oh, really?
Constantly bombarded with hackathon requests. So what IBM actually did really, really well through this campaign is realizing that they knew their audience, they knew that they were being bombarded with hackathons, but they changed it from being a hackathon for a business solution to a hackathon for using their skills for good.
Yeah.
You know, anyone who knows the development community knows they love a challenge. They absolutely love a challenge. And what bigger challenge than trying to sort out humanity?
Yeah. Yeah.
So it was really interesting, actually. And it's one of the things I love so much about the campaign was that, yeah, developers are getting a bit sick of the hackathon thing. So looking at that emotional way to engage them has been, they've absolutely hit the mark with IBM. Yeah.
So when you do it, even with something as apparently forward thinking as a hackathon, you've still got to think about how can you do it differently? How can you get the cut through?
Yeah, and that comes back to that emotional engagement rather than just customer engagement or customer experience. Mm. It comes back to that piece of actually really diving into your audience, really understanding that persona and thinking what emotionally would tie them to the brand. Having emotional engagement throughout all of your campaigns is so intrinsic to making your community, making your customers realize that this isn't just sales, this isn't just marketing, this is a difference that you're making as a human being, this will make to your career.
And is that your takeaway for applying to your future thinking? Actually, don't think about the emotional as much as the rational.
Yeah, and it sounds really bad to think of emotional engagement as a tactic almost, because it absolutely is something we should all be doing anyway, but absolutely is something that I'm taking forward in my own role. Societal impact is huge. So, for instance, we actually helped found a body called the Inclusive Tech Alliance. So they focus exclusively on changing the top-level C-suite and making sure that Black and minority ethnics absolutely are included and that we get diversity across everything that we do. Mm. So as an agency, it means that our clients are actually genuinely engaging with us. You know, clients and prospects are genuinely engaging with us because they're really interested as a person as to what this community can do and the difference that they can make. Now, obviously, that's going to have an impact on us because it means that we're building relationships with our customers. They're in turn talking about the brilliant things that we do in their own communities when actually they're going away, they're with their communities, not wanting to sell to people, not wanting to pitch another agency to go on their roster because that's all they have to talk about all the time. So actually, companies, client side and agency side, really should look at how societal impact can make a difference to their bottom line, because it really does.
Alex Weber, it's been brilliant having you on the podcast. Thanks for coming along.
Thanks very much, and thanks for listening.
There's the closing klaxon, which means that's it for this episode of the Business Marketing Club podcast. Thanks to my guests, Matt Morrison, Santu Kottala, Ben Perkins, Ros Barkley and Alexandra Weber. And thanks to you for listening. Please do let us know what you've thought of today's podcast. You can give us a rating or a review or drop us a line at businessmarketingclub.org.uk. And hey, if you've got something interesting, practical and visionary to share with our listeners, why not volunteer to be a guest on a future podcast? No sales pitches though, no product demos, please. Definitely no creds presentations, absolutely no theoretical nonsense, but everything else would be great. And hey, you might want to think about joining the Business Marketing Club for events, mentoring and thought leadership for the B2B marketing community. Go on, what's stopping you? I've been Dave Stevens. I still am Dave Stevens. Thank you very much for listening.